And now Micah Miller trying to spring a pass ahead. Nobody in front of Jack Paling. Moves on with a blast and scores!
Giving up on chances, and we just gotta bottom line execute.
Waits, passes in front, great save, Pelosi, as she robs a Gopher in front of her, and that was number 8, Kippen Keller, on the grade A opportunity.
For me as a coach, that's the kind of D you're always looking for, because they don't grow on trees for sure, and he's done a really good job being a captain of a really young team this year.
It's a really cool thing to see for them to really appreciate what I've done on and off the ice.
To the far half wall, Jack Paling. Trying to play it into the corner. Now Paling turns, squares his body to the slot, sends it up high toward Jack. Shaw makes his play through and they score! Right along the blue line, Nick Paling was in front of the net and St. Cloud State's got a lead here in the corner.
And welcome back, Huskies Warm and House podcast fans. It's the Back to School Special, episode number 25. On today's episode, a college hockey legend from the University of Minnesota will join us this week. We also will tack on some of the news and notes surrounding college hockey and his run with the NHL. But let's first welcome in my co-host, I'm Nick Maxson. Let's welcome in Noah Grant. Noah, how are things up in North Dakota so far this weekend?
You know what? It's been all right. Finally, the internet's working in the house again. Turns out my printer was the only thing disrupting my internet bandwidth. That's odd to me. But you know what? I'm doing all right. I was being introspective today. I don't know if I have that ability.
It's a big word for you.
Yeah, I know. Able to do that. But I was just thinking about, you know, we finally got our hats out for the two-line fan trivia. We're hopefully getting t-shirts ordered and that sort of thing. And we've just had a lot of fans that either have followed us or reached out and said, thank you for doing what you do and that sort of thing. And it, like, to put it in perspective, Nick, right? You know, like, a lot of people are starting to kind of figure out, like, this is our show. This is what we do. We've been doing it consistently, right? But you and I both know that this has been at least probably a 9-month process in the planning of creating this and slowly refining it and getting feedback, you know, from guys like Bill Prout and people who have been so integral, not to mention our fans. So I was just kind of thinking about, like, I can count on probably not on both hands enough times that we've thought where we've been like, gosh, I don't know if we can continue to keep doing this. Like, this is really hard. And, you know, we've had people that have supported us, you know, including our fans. So I guess, like, I'm just really grateful. I'm really grateful that I get to sit here on Saturday, August 22nd and get to release an episode where a very important guest from the Minnesota Gophers joined us. I mean, it's kind of a pinch me moment. So thank you to all of our fans for helping us out. I don't know if that was a little bit sappy, but that's how my Saturday is going.
Well, I think it's important to notice, mention, you know, we've talked about this off the air quite a bit, which is, you know, why we can still do this during a pandemic. I mean, we certainly took a few weeks off as things were really just starting to evolve. And I think, you know, we just said, you know, hey, we don't know how long this is going to last. This is a good avenue to keep our chops up, to keep talking about the hockey scene, and to really just, again, have fun with it, right? I mean, the whole reason why we're doing this is to have fun. And we both have played the game, we both have broadcasted the game, and we just love the game. We eat, sleep, and, well, for back of a lot of words, drink it, go Huskies, woo. But at the end of the day, I mean, this is fun for us. And it's been great to see, as you mentioned, the support we've had from the fans, as well as, you know, the university. And so, as you mentioned, some very key folks who have helped take this to the level that we're at now. So definitely thankful for all those folks who give us a follow every single week. It's certainly been a blast for us to put this on with all the hard work that goes into it, Noah. But with that being said, let's get into our opening draw. We have to talk about the two-line sports trivia. So I want you to update. We had a winner this week, and not once, but second time's a charm. And this winner will be getting a new Huskies Warm and House hat. I did get mine this week in the mail, Noah. And, you know, kind of funny, there was the word fragile written on the box that I got in the mail. So it is a very, very good piece of athletic wear to have on your hat. Again, from Unreal, a local company here in St. Paul. But why don't you fill us in on the winner for this week, Noah?
Two Line Fan Trivia is your chance to win. Follow the Huskies Warming House podcast on Twitter at Warming House Den. A new question will be asked every week. Be the first to tweet us the correct answer. Winners will be mentioned on the show, as well as a chance for prizes and more. One question, one answer, one winner. It's Two Line Trivia.
Yeah, Nick, as you mentioned, Two Line Fan Trivia. This week we did have a new winner, so somebody else is getting one of those new hats that you just mentioned. Super stoked about that. And the question reads here, the St. Cloud State men's hockey team has played the University of Minnesota Golden Gopher Hockey 102 times in Division I era. On March 2nd and 3rd of 2001, the Gophers, led by today's guest, faced our former guest in Craig Dahl. Dahl's Huskies earned St. Cloud State's third ever sweep of the Gophers. What were the scores of both games? Nick, do you happen to have any idea what the answer is, or what the combined scores might be? Is maybe a better avenue to go for you on this one.
You know, I do know the Huskies scored 11 goals in the two games, and I think if I recall, it was 3 goals against within the two. Am I right?
That is correct. First time for everything, Nick Maxson is correct here. Oh my
God. There is a, please savor the moment because it might not happen again.
So Johnny Mack was our winner at Fight the Pants, which is, that's awesome. Just an awesome handle. But the scores, it was actually a home and home series that weekend. 6-1 in Minneapolis and 5-2 at home for the St. Cloud State Huskies to complete the sweep, a combined score of 11-3. And don't forget, Dahl's 2000-2001 Huskies that season are tied for the most wins in team history. So kind of cool to see all of our guests. Of course, I believe Bob Motzko was part of that group on the bench, too, for the University of Minnesota as well. So just really cool to see all of our guests kind of intertwine a little bit. Nick, once again, just a real pinch me moment, right?
A real pinch me moment, but it just shows you just how close-knit the hockey community is. You know, we talk about Dave Schack. We'll get into some news surrounding another college hockey team, Don Lucia. We'll talk about some of that later, but also spending time, the new associate head coach that is coming over to us from Western Michigan will obviously have some insight onto a team out west, as you want to call it here, Noah. But it's also, I think, good to mention, too, that you know, with us doing this podcast, we also have to mention the tape-to-tape breakdown. It comes out during the midweek. Last segment we did was on another little of a Gopher moment, too, a little bit of a breakaway from Justin Hall, that 0.6 seconds. Just heartbreaker for if you're a Fighting Hawks fan. And as you mentioned during the taping of that episode, certainly for us here as St. Cloud State fans, no tears shed when you see Fighting Hawks players with their faces towards the benches. But with that, Noah, I think it is time to get into Center Ice View News and Notes.
Center Ice View News and Notes. Center Ice View provides you with the best coverage of St. Cloud State Huskies hockey, from game notes, recaps, photos, and more. Go to centericeview.com.
And first, Noah, on today's Center Ice View News and Notes, a couple of tidbits surrounding men's hockey here for St. Cloud State. St. Cloud getting a verbal commitment from 16-year-old forward Max Montez out of Wisconsin. He had actually been drafted by the OHL, by the Prince Albert Raiders, I believe. Or if Matt mean not the London Knights, one of the two, but will actually play this season in the USHL. Highly touted forward, and again, not a signing commitment, but a verbal commitment, a very talented forward that should be coming over to the Huskies in a couple of years. So again, you talk about how important recruiting is. We've talked about it with Brett Larson. Certainly there's been a push for some older players, but again, when you find a young stud that you can try to get some sort of commitment to, they've got one here from 16-year-old Max Montez, again, playing his junior hockey in Wisconsin. So some exciting stuff there. Another little tidbit here, Noah. Incoming freshman VT Miettinen coming over from Finland. Sounds like he will be in the St. Cloud area here in the next probably little bit here. Was recently featured on a piece from The Athletic and basically touting how he's basically the best underrated top forward prospect that's out there. In St. Cloud State, he's going to have him play at least as long as we hope college hockey season starts this season. So interesting read that St. Cloud may have you know, quite the forward coming over that, from what we see with his time in Finland, he's pretty much dominated every single place that he's been.
Yeah, kind of. He wanted to take a little bit of the untraditional route, and you know, he's a real academic fella, you know, which is really cool to kind of see somebody come over and really embrace that culture, because what better place to do it than college hockey, right? If you're good at the game of hockey and you like school, what better place than St. Cloud State? So good to see him kind of jump into that role a little bit. And, you know, if you're talking about a guy who arguably has the potential, you know, to earn himself a pro contract and that sort of thing and develop, you know, and I wouldn't say, I mean, he's not going to improve his draft stock because he's not going to be drafted, but kind of improve his stock of what these NHL clubs see of him. You know, it kind of similar to a guy, you know, Sam Hentges, a late round draft pick, a guy like Jack Eichon, a couple guys who, you know, really have a couple of tools in their toolbox and they're just trying to refine and really grow that tool set as they, you know, go to school at St. Cloud State. So really exciting for him to not only jump into the St. Cloud system, but then speaking of Sam Hentges, Nick, you know, the Minnesota Wild, I hear they're looking for a couple of really talented hockey players that might be under the radar. So having him, you know, less than 2 hours away from St. Paul and the Xcel Energy Center, not a bad gig if you're Vitny Mietinen trying to prove yourself to an NHL club close to home.
And no question, he was fielding pro offers while he was in Finland. Again, he did not go up to the Finnish Pro League. He decided against that. Again, keeping the notion that he wants to go the unconventional route. He'll come his way over to North America. He will be going to school here at St. Cloud State. And from what the article mentioned is that actually was some concern just because of how good he was from both the St. Cloud State staff as well in Finland that he actually could sign a pro contract. So there's some highly touting from this kid. He's not the biggest kid, maybe 5'8", 160. His initial central scouting ranking for this year was a C, which would put him as a fifth, a sixth, or maybe in a seventh round draft pick, but has since been pushed up to the mid 70s. So as you mentioned, it could be that mid round steal. You know, again, we talk about Kirill Kaprizov being a fifth round pick, and right now is the best pretty much prospect outside the NHL, just signed his contract. So we'll see what he can show us here at the NCAA level when he does get around. So kind of happy to see St. Cloud State and some young prospects making some headlines before they even skate a game, Noah.
You know, and the other thing too is, like you mentioned, you know, talking about it, obviously St. Cloud's not going to complain about getting a player that quote unquote might be too good. I certainly, you know, wouldn't be worried about that. But the one thing I think Huskies fans, you know, at least have to keep aware of, because I think from what we've heard from some of the players, is that he's arriving hopefully at the end of this month, at the end of August. But you know, COVID is still a real thing. So hopefully, you know, when you mentioned about signing pro contracts, hopefully he's able to at least get in a Huskies uniform, have a season, you know, kind of just get a feel for the college game a little bit. Because, you know, similar to, you know, with Vitny Mietinen, I should say, David Rennick's kind of in that similar boat as a senior for the Huskies, where, you know, if the season's a little bit more in doubt on the college side, that the NHL might come calling for both of these players. But nonetheless, exciting times, and hoping to see both of them in a St. Cloud State sweater and kind of tearing up the NCHC a little bit this year.
In NHL news, Noah, as we switch gears, a little bit of a sad moment here as we learned that the passing of NHL All-Star and Hall of Famer Dale Hawerchuk. Again, a big face, especially in Canadian hockey, was a five-time All-Star, a big face of the Winnipeg Jets. In fact, the Winnipeg Jets organization took down his banner that retired his jersey and took it from the top, actually put it in the rotunda so people could go actually pay their respects. You have been reading throughout social media, certainly from Canadian news as well as here in the USA hockey news circles, of just how much of an impact he's left on the game of hockey. I'll kind of turn it over to you because, I mean, just a pretty big figure that NHL has lost after a short battle with cancer, unfortunately.
Yeah, we'd definitely be remiss if we didn't kind of touch on some of the higher points of his career, just because, you know, it is such a legendary career. And unfortunately, you know, we lost him way too soon. 57 is such a young age, but, you know, 57 really good years. And this information comes from the New York Times. He was drafted in 1981 as an 18-year-old. He played that same year for the Winnipeg Jets, you know, 45 goals in his first year and the youngest player at that time to break 100 points in his, you know, youngest season, I should say, with 103 points. Was finally broken by Sidney Crosby in 2006, but he led Winnipeg that year to a 48-point turnaround in the standings, which to this date is still the largest in NHL history from a season-to-season differential. Like you mentioned, 16 seasons, 9 of those were for the original Winnipeg Jets. He also played in St. Louis and Philly, 5-time All-Star, 1,409 points in 1,188 games. So he definitely got his cup of coffee and then some, certainly earned it. And he was just getting ready to enter his 10th season coaching, actually, for the Barry Colts, in the OHL as head coach. They had 6 playoff appearances. And like you mentioned, Hockey Hall of Fame inductee in 2001. And Nick, when I was kind of reading this article, among the multitude of articles that, you know, that have been fantastically done on his career, one of the things that really stands out for me is his quote when he was finally inducted into the Hockey Hall of Fame. He said, and I quote, "All the experiences have been fantastic. Even though I didn't win a Stanley Cup, I still wouldn't change a thing. I think to ask for more would be greedy." You know, and of course, his very last season in 1997 was a Stanley Cup final appearance with the Philadelphia Flyers. And, you know, just to hear that from someone who, you know, wasn't able to hoist hockey's ultimate prize, but just did so much, especially, you know, for a Canadian team. It's just really fantastic to see the support for a player that, you know, even to this day, maybe just doesn't get the credit he deserves for helping mold the game in the way he does. Wasn't a big guy, 5'11", you know, kind of a scrappy dude, but, you know, really good anticipation. Kind of reminds me of, you know, Mr. Number 99 for the Edmonton Oilers and LA Kings, but certainly will be sorely missed, especially in the Winnipeg community, for sure.
I think it's important to go back to that quote, Noel, because you talk about a guy, you know, pro sports, obviously today, the culture of pro sports is a little bit different now than it was back then. But I think it's cool to really kind of be refreshed as to know that he understood that, you know, he was in a very awesome spot, that, you know, he got to go out, he got to lace up some skates and play professional hockey. And that, you know, despite not winning a Stanley Cup, he had multiple playoff appearances, again, setting records as a young player. He had done a lot, and he had a lot of really good experiences while playing in the NHL. And he was very thankful of that and aware that not everybody gets to do this. And I think it's refreshing to hear that, you know, for someone who had a Hall of Fame career, that they know that, yes, I didn't win the ultimate prize. You know, I had multiple shots at it, just couldn't quite get it. But even then, you can't take away those memories that you make when you're skating up and, you know, playing in some of the buildings that he did. So I think it's really awesome to hear that. And certainly, as you mentioned, will be a figure that the hockey community will be sad to miss, and our thoughts go out to his family and certainly the players and the coaches and everybody that he touched. So with that, a loss of Dale Hollerchuk, certainly a sting on the hockey community. But going back to hockey, Noel, to switch gears a little bit one more time, we have to do a little bit of a roundup because round one is now officially over for the NHL playoffs, and we need to recap that and then just do a quick preview of the other matchups here for round two. So some pretty exciting hockey here in the month of August. Yes, not August, not April, not May.
Yeah, kind of excited as these rounds go along. When we do these roundups, they get easier and easier because more teams are exiting the bubble. And actually probably wasn't really expecting this last round one, I should say, to be over so early. But a lot of these series did end in 5 or 6 games. No series made it to 7 games in the first round of the playoffs. I can't remember the last time that's maybe happened. There's usually there's usually every probably one round in every playoff where it's kind of like that, where it's a little bit, not really lopsided, but, you know, a bunch of teams just kind of find the handle early and just get that pivotal balance to end series a little bit earlier. But nonetheless, Nick, we've got hockey on the docket. There's actually one game in the second round starting tonight. That's Colorado and Dallas. So let's break it down for you. We'll start with the East a little bit here. Number one, Philadelphia, who I believe is a very dangerous hockey team. They matched up against the now lowest ranked team in the playoffs remaining in the New York Islanders. Of course, Philadelphia had a pretty gritty and kind of controversial series against Montreal in 6 games. And then the New York Islanders handily dispatched the Washington Capitals in 5 games. Nick, kind of your thoughts on this series. You know, who do you maybe think has the upper hand on this one? It's a little bit of, I wouldn't say offense, but just kind of like stingy offense versus stingy defense, if you ask me.
I think I actually have an underdog pick on this one. Philadelphia certainly has a lot of firepower when they're clicking in all cylinders. Montreal showed that if you can play a little bit stingy in the middle of the ice, and when you have a goaltender that's playing really well, they can be a team that can be kind of cooled off a bit. The New York Islanders and Coach Barry Trotz, when they play their style of game, which is to really make life not very easy for you, especially through the neutral zone, especially in the defensive zone, we saw how Semyon Varlamov looked against the Capitals. It was a very, almost a clinic in how they dispatched the Capitals in 5 games. It was quite interesting to watch. So I really do think that this is a more evenly matched series than people really give it credit to. If it becomes more wide open, that will favor Philly. However, if Islanders can slow the game down, if they can really control the middle of the ice between the two blue lines, and again, Anthony Beauvillier and Matthew Barzal, I mean, they still have some scoring power from them as well. And you got to forget, too, that the New York Islanders have probably the best fourth line in I Love Hockey with Clutterbuck, Martin, and Casey Cizikas. So I do think that this is going to be a series that could go 6 or 7 games. I actually have an edge to the New York Islanders because of their depth as well as how well their defense has been playing.
Yeah, I definitely like that analysis. I mean, you look at the Montreal Canadiens, that was their MO against Pittsburgh, and they took Philadelphia to 6 games playing that defensive structure and just kind of trying to capitalize on those turnovers and opportunities. So, you know, I don't know, for me, I think Carter Hart's going to stand tall. I think Philadelphia, I think it's their time to maybe make another deep playoff run. So I'm going to give the edge to Philly on that, but certainly don't disagree with you and would not be surprised if we see this one maybe go the distance. But nonetheless, another series that might actually go the distance too, and really the tail of the tape leads up to this series. It's the Tampa Bay Lightning in the number two spot against Boston, who is fourth overall. Tampa, of course, ousted the Columbus Blue Jackets in five games, and only one of those games was not decided by a goal, and it was decided by two goals in that series. And then on the flip side, Boston finished off Carolina, and every game in that five-game series was a one-goal game, a couple of overtimes, including a double overtime in game one. Certainly doesn't match the Tampa Bay Lightning five-overtime game that we had against Columbus. I was surprised ABC both of those series be knocked off in as quick fashion as they were, because they were a lot tighter than the final series score indicates. But geez, Nick, I don't know. Do you think the Tampa Bay Lightning finally find a way to return to form like they did when they made a Stanley Cup final? 6 years ago now?
Yes. For Tampa, this was such a great learning lesson for them to go back and to exercise some demons one. But again, Columbus, as you mentioned, they did not make this easy for them at all. You talk about Tampa winning in five games. Again, a couple overtime games. It was scrappy. I mean, there was a couple of blown leads by both teams. This was a good first series to go against Boston. Again, Boston's not going to be any easier of an opponent. And more importantly, Boston is a team that's got, you talk about offensive firepower. Again, you talk about David Pastrnak, which finally got into the playoffs. You talk about Patrice Bergeron, David Krejci, who's had a heck of a playoff so far. This team can score. And this team, again, stays wide open. I think you're going to see Tampa going to have to lock down the neutral zone against Boston to really take care of their own end. Andre Vasilevsky, big part of that net. And if you're Tampa, you have to go after Yaroslav Halak. I mean, a guy who can still play good in goal, but certainly not to the caliber of you would have in Tuukka Rask. So if Tampa can get some shots on net and stay out of the box, they could have an edge. But this is another really evenly matched series, and one that will have to have exercise patience from both sides, because again, both teams, if you make a mistake in either one of those, ends up in the back of your own net.
Yeah, I definitely think it's going to come down to goaltending. I think Vasilevsky is going to have to be sharp. And, you know, if you're Tampa Bay, you know, especially exercising those playoff demons, you need a couple guys. You need your Kucherovs, your points, you know, guys like that to just kind of step up and really have a consistency where one guy, if he struggles for a couple games, you know, another guy just has to step up. I know that sounds obvious, but it's like that's kind of been Tampa Bay's woes, is their big guns have really disappeared at key moments. Obviously, Boston's didn't disappear until game seven of the last game of the season last year. So like you mentioned, should be a good one. I feel like it's Tampa Bay's time to shine, just because their play-by-play announcer is on his way out. I think maybe a chance to give him one more shot at a Stanley Cup would be kind of cool. Anyway, moving to the West, a team that was just in the Stanley Cup final a mere 2 years ago, the Vegas Golden Knights, in the number one overall seed, faced the Young Guns in the Vancouver Canucks at number five overall. Vegas pretty much controlled the series, I would say, against Chicago, beating them in five games, although Corey Crawford was probably the reason it didn't end in four. He was fantastic, and Chicago has some big decisions regarding Corey Crawford as they move forward in the offseason. And Vancouver, as Minnesota Wild fans know, had some gutsy wins against the defending champion Blues, got rid of them in six games, and Jordan Binnington never really found his game. He went 0-5. He was sub-900 in terms of save percentage. But Vancouver, you know, they didn't really blow out, you know, much of that series in that respect, though. You know, they've still had some really tight hockey games, so it's almost like, I don't want to use the term riding the wave, because their rookies and their young guns have been really impressive for the Canucks, but it's kind of like, you know, can they sustain that for another round, and then another round, and then another round, if they can find a way to push it all the way to a Stanley Cup final? I don't know. I think Vegas, I feel like they just have too much firepower. I think they're a little bit too deep. Really good goaltending depth with a 1-2 punch in Fleury and Lehner. But Nick, who do you give the edge to in this series?
To me, Vegas has an edge, but it's not by much. I mean, I love the quote from Vancouver's head coach Travis Green when he was asked about, you know, going into game six and having the ability to knock off the St. Louis Blues, the defending Stanley Cup champion. And he said, we're not learning how to play in the playoffs. We're learning how to win right now. And you really got the sense that these rookies, again, Quinn Hughes, Elias Pettersson, just name a couple of them, this group played it like seasoned pros, like they've been there before. This is a team that looks really good. Game five, Jacob Markstrom nearly stole that game from him. He just played outstanding. So to me, Vancouver is riding actually a little wave of momentum here. They're feeling good. They feel like they can actually go in and compete. Now, to your point, Vegas to me has the better depth. I think the fourth line combinations between the two teams is going to be the big battle. Ryan Reese versus Antoine Roussel, who can really not only kind of impose their will, that game within the game, as you call it, Noah, but also staying out of the penalty box. Vancouver's a team that can score. They were over 25% of the power play throughout the series against St. Louis. So being disciplined, but also, again, goaltending will be a big in the series. But I think Vegas, again, with their depth as well, especially in the back end with the offensive problems, to me, Vegas should be the one on top out of this series.
Yeah, fourth line is going to be important. I believe Jay Beagle has the worst Corsi four of any forward in the National Hockey League as well. Pretty good with draws, but other than that, he really struggles to kind of keep shot suppression and the play out of his own zone. So we'll have to see how they match up. I did read a tweet this last week, a pretty good one from a Vegas Golden Knights themed podcast that said, a scientist recently mentioned the Marianas Trench is the deepest item in the world. And then someone said, have you taken a look at the Vegas Golden Knights depth chart? But nonetheless, it should be a good one. The young guns against the slightly less young guns in the Vegas Golden Knights. And the final series in the West, one that I'm really looking forward to watch. I think this one's going to be a high-octane series. The Colorado Avalanche coming in at number two against the Dallas Stars at number three. They're the only game that's going on tonight, this Saturday. Colorado thrashed Arizona in five games. It was a tight series, and then Colorado just decided to be really good, I guess, about outscoring Arizona by a combined score of 14-2 in the last two games of that series. That's just, I mean, I'm not surprising with guys like Nathan MacKinnon and, you know, Gabriel Landeskog and all the firepower they have, but still, it's holy smokes. And then on the other side, Dallas, kind of in come from behind fashion, took a little bit to found their game, but they throttled Calgary in stark fashion in six games, in the final game, I should say, by a final score of 7-3 to punch
their scoring seven straight, to be honest. Yeah,
to punch their ticket to the next round to face the Avalanche. I don't know, Nick. I as much as I think that Colorado is the better team on paper,
they are.
I feel like this is the series where Dallas finally finds their groove a little bit. Obviously, they had a really great second round against, you know, the St. Louis Blues in game seven double overtime. I see you kind of shaking your head. I feel like you're going to disagree with me a little bit. I just feel like Dallas has yet to really find that extra gear that they were starting to find in the season. Do I think they're going to win the series? I don't know, but I think that this one definitely has the potential to go to at least six, if not the full seven games.
It's concerning for Dallas fans because, well, number one, we don't know the status of Ben Bishop. He's still unfit to play. To me, the key for Dallas is going to be, you know, obviously Anton Hudobin, but more importantly, Miro Heiskanen and John Klingberg. The defense for Dallas is going to have to somehow control that offense for Colorado, a very high-flying, high-octane offense from the Avalanche. Having to stop Nathan MacKinnon, having to stop Landeskog, Mikko Rantanen, and the Nazem Kadri's had a pretty darn good playoff so far for the Colorado Avalanche. That depth chart is scary. And then you throw in a rookie defenseman by the name of Cale Makar, a guy who can certainly move his feet, walk the blue line, and has a pretty good shot. I mean, these guys can score from anywhere. To me, Dallas, what concerns me more about them is that can they match the offensive firepower? Dallas is good when they can get some extra man advantages and they can stay out of the box. But to me, if Colorado, if they can get a cycle game going, if Nathan MacKinnon, if they can get the 30-40 shots a game that they did in Arizona, it's going to be a very tough series for Dallas. So, again, Dallas is going to have to try to find a way to cycle, wear down the defense of Colorado, which can be susceptible at times. But you have to look at it as a long series. You're going to have to look at it as four, five, six games that you have to be punishing on the forecheck, and you have to be physical with these guys, really clog up the neutral zone, force them to chip the puck in, go and chase it, maybe wear them down over the course of a series, as we talked about before. That's the only way to meet Dallas is going to be able to beat Colorado. There's too much talent. There's too much depth. And when Philip Grubauer has been playing well, when he hasn't been seeing high-quality shots, to meet Dallas, one thing they've been lacking is the consistent high danger chances, especially in their last series. They kind of snuck out of one with Calgary with self-imploding. After they were down 3-0 in the first, get a timeout, they score seven straight to steal that game from Calgary, which thought they had it in cruise control there in game six. So I don't know. To me, I don't see it as that close as you do. But again, this is the Stanley Cup playoffs for a reason, and we've seen stranger things happen. So, but to me, Colorado should have a much bigger edge to me in this series.
Yeah, every shift we're going to be watching intently. And, you know, another team whose shifts we're going to be watching intently, we're going to touch on this one after we have our special guest. But our special guest did touch on this a little bit. The University of Alaska Anchorage will be our topic and kind of their final season, potentially, not potentially, legitimately, coming up this year if we do even have a season. So we did ask our special guest about this, some clarification on that. But Nick, maybe kind of fill us in on our special guest, which, for me, I know it's a St. Cloud State-based podcast, but this man pretty much encapsulated what my childhood of watching college hockey looked like. And this interview was just an absolute blast.
It was, again, a legend in college hockey coaching, no question. A two-time national champion winner. Certainly coached, one of the better coaching records you'll see out there. Over 700 career winning percentage again. As we welcome in our Healthy Scratch interview for this week, it is former head coach and now current CCHA commissioner, which is set to begin play next season, Don Lucia.
With a new guest joining every week, it's a lineup chock full of players, coaches, fans, and more. This week's special guest is the Healthy Scratch.
The Healthy Scratch interview segment, a very special guest, former University of Minnesota Golden Gophers head coach and now current commissioner of the CCHA Hockey Conference, which is set to begin play next season in 2021. Don Lucia, the Grand Rapids native, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thanks, guys. My pleasure to be on with you.
Don, you don't become a head coach in college hockey without playing the game yourself. I want to start a little bit with your playing career. Starting off with your time at the University of Notre Dame, you were a defenseman with them back in the 80s. Talk to me a little bit about what it was playing for the Ivy League school, a school that your son Mario also played a little bit there as well.
Well, I'm going to make a couple corrections right off the bat. First of all, it was in the late 70s. That's how old I'm getting. And I think back at the time I played, we were in the WCHA. And you go back in time, the WCHA back in the day in the 70s included Notre Dame, Michigan, Michigan State, and then, you know, Michigan Tech was in it at that time, along with Duluth, North Dakota, Wisconsin, Minnesota, Denver, CC. So it was a great 10-team league. And actually, after my senior year, the breakoff started, and that's had a lot to do with Title IX and gearing up for women's sports. So in 1981, Michigan, Michigan State, Notre Dame, and Michigan Tech all moved over to the CCHA and left the WCHA with a 16-member league, and that's when they began their interlocking schedule with Hockey East in order to get enough games. And I think it certainly helped the WCHA at that time with only six members, but I think it really helped launch the Hockey East League back at that time when they traveled back and forth and played each team. But I had a lot of great memories in my time at Notre Dame and in the WCHA. It's a little different. Nobody had great venues at the time. Nobody had all the bells and whistles that you see in facilities and weight rooms that they do now. So you went more for the education. You didn't really think about playing professional hockey at that time. So because very few people even played at that date. You look at how recruiting is today and, you know, recruiting 14, 15-year-olds back in the mid-70s, I mean, you didn't even think about recruiting until after the state tournament was over your senior year, and that's certainly what happened. I think I took my visit after the state tournament, and, you know, it worked out great for me to be able to go to Notre Dame. I grew up, my dad was a high school football coach, so I was more in tune with college football probably even than college hockey growing up in northern Minnesota. And back in the day, the Notre Dame had the Sunday morning football, like an hour and a half show, a little abbreviated of their game from the day before because there was only one game a day in college football back in the 70s. And so I had that, and my cousin was attending Notre Dame at the time. So it really was a great fit because, again, at Notre Dame, they were coming back to play at Duluth, at North Dakota, at Minnesota. So, you know, friends and family could still attend games.
You know, everybody knows you, you know, as the University of Minnesota Golden Gophers head coach, 19 seasons, your total record as a coach, however, you know, you sit sixth all time in coaching history with over 600 wins, you know, 624 winning percentage, but you don't just become the University of Minnesota coach, right? It doesn't just happen. And one of the most impressive statistics, I think, from your early coaching days at Alaska Fairbanks and Colorado College is, especially at CC, your winning percentage in those 12 seasons that you coached at both of those schools. First of all, how did you get into the kind of independent / Division I coaching level? And then how did you have so much success at schools that really weren't powerhouse schools in a league that didn't really have a whole lot of parity back then, I should say?
Well, if you go back when I was recruited in Notre Dame by Rick Schaefer, he was assistant coach at the time. And going into my senior year in college, he left to go start the program at Alaska Fairbanks. So the spring of my senior year, he had, you know, written me a note, wanted to know if I wanted to come up and help him, you know, getting the program started. Wasn't quite sure what I wanted to do. I had been drafted by the Flyers in college, but I knew I probably wasn't going to be good enough to ever play in the NHL. I was ready at that point in my life to kind of get on with post-hockey. So I remember I flew up to Alaska in June. Obviously, a lot of sunshine, that 24 hours of daylight. And I registered for grad school. And so I went up there, and in September, a former teammate of mine was actually going to transfer up there. And so we drove up the Alaska Highway together and got in, I think, the end of August. I moved into the dorm. So I basically was on a scholarship to, they paid for my tuition. I worked in a rink. I drove the Zamboni. So I'm one of the few guys that actually knows how to drive the Zamboni. And there was days when I actually, even when I became the head coach, when I'd run the first half of practice, take my skates off, drive the Zamboni, clear the ice, put my skates back on, run the second half of practice. But that's kind of how it was done back in the day. So I went up there for a couple of years. It was a grad assistant. And then they created a full-time assistant coaching position for me. So that would have been 1983. I was there for a couple more years at University of Alaska Fairbanks. I went down to Anchorage for 2 years from 85 to 87. And then in 1987, Rick got the head coaching job back at Notre Dame. And then they called me to take his spot in Fairbanks. So, you know, I had met my wife. She was born and raised in Fairbanks. So we went back to Fairbanks, and I was young. I think I was 28 when I was hired as a head coach. And it was a great training ground because you kind of had to do it all. It wasn't like the big staffs or anything like that. So we were at Division I independent at the time. You know, our recruiting base was Western Canada, Alaskan kids. So we kind of knew our niche. There was fewer teams back at that time. So a lot of good players in Western Canada that you could go kind of siphon off, you know, in March when everybody else was in their playoffs. We'd be going on a 2 or 3 week recruiting trip all across the prairies and British Columbia and Alberta and kind of get our team at that point in time. So we were more than competitive, and we had a lot of good players. 93, I ended up applying for the Colorado College job. I had applied for a few others, never could get an interview, so it was kind of on a whim. I decided to apply. Went and interviewed that May and was able to get the job. So it worked out great for me. I love Colorado College. The Colorado Springs area is a beautiful area. You know, the Broadmoor got torn down after my first year. And we had to play at the Air Force Academy for 3.5 years until the World Arena was finished. But, you know, I walked into a good situation. There was a lot of good players at the time. We were able to win 3 straight championships in the WCHA. Still to this day, probably the biggest disappointment in my coaching career was losing to Michigan in 96 in the national title game in overtime. Brendan Morrison still. So see that highlight, it's like a dagger. That was a really fun team, and we kind of grew together over 3 years. But I had a lot of good memories. And I never set out in my coaching career to say, geez, I want to be the head coach at the University of Minnesota. It was never in my wheelhouse. And then I got a call, and Mark Dienhart flew out to Denver. I met him in 99, and we were able to talk about what the job entailed. You know, I think I was a good fit at the time. I was from Minnesota, had that background. We had been successful in the WCHA. So it was one of those I felt if I didn't take the job, I might regret it the rest of my life. You know, being born and raised in Minnesota, never had a chance to play at the U, but it was obviously a great opportunity to coach. And a lot of great memories. We had some certainly terrific players, great coaches I had an opportunity to work with. And I feel blessed that I had a chance to work there as long as I did.
Coach, obviously, you know, you talk about being able to come back to Minnesota and coach. And, you know, one of the moments I think that was a highlight probably for you was obviously winning the national championship in 2002 in St. Paul in front of a packed Xcel Energy Center. For college hockey, you mentioned your playing days, and you don't have the venues like you mentioned, but you have a full 18,000-seat Xcel Energy Center when you're winning the national title. Can you just describe to me what the emotions was like winning that game in front of just a packed house? I mean, and how special that moment was for you?
Well, it really was. And you go back, there was a lot of pressure on that group to try to get to St. Paul and play in that Frozen Four. And I remember beating, it turned out to be Colorado College in the regional final to get to St. Paul. And just the euphoria in the locker room, the excitement knowing that we were going to be able to play the Frozen Four in St. Paul. It was a great field with Michigan and I believe UNH was in it in Maine. And then, we had to play Michigan. It was funny because at the time, I said that when I became the coach of Minnesota, there was a couple teams, if we weren't going to compete at the highest level, we're going to have to beat. One was Michigan. You know, they had won it in 96, 98. North Dakota had a great run going at that time with Dean. And that was another team. And, kind of on our journey, we beat North Dakota in the first round of the WCHA playoffs. And then we beat Michigan in the semifinals and get an opportunity to play for that national championship game. I can't imagine what the disappointment would have been like had we not won. Interestingly enough, I was in the stands when Minnesota lost to Harvard. I was coaching up in Alaska, and I was recruiting in the spring, and that's back in the day. It would have been 89, if my memory serves me, that the Frozen Fours weren't necessarily sellouts at that point in time. And so I was able to get a ticket, and I was actually at that game. And to see the disappointment in the Minnesota fans. So for us to be able to win that game at home, it just doesn't get any better than that. I know a lot of people, even that had worked at ESPN, said that was one of the best atmospheres for any sporting event they'd ever been at. So I think just the relief for everybody had been so long since a national title for hockey, a lot of close misses, a lot of Frozen Fours. But that relief of winning it all, and then how special we did it to tie it in the last minute and then win it in overtime.
You know, so this is a St. Cloud State podcast, but as I detailed to you before we came on the show, I grew up as a Gophers fan, obviously watched your entire tenure as a coach. And there's about five moments that really stick out to me. One of them that I was at, and you know, feel free to not answer if you don't want to, but I kind of want to know, through 19 years, these pivotal moments, I kind of want to know what's going through your mind when these events happen. Some of them are good, some of them are bad, but we're going to jump right into them. The first one is the one that I was at. 2006, powerhouse Golden Gopher team in Grand Forks, Holy Cross, Kellen Briggs gets beat in overtime. Can you kind of just take us through not only really what that team was like, but just, you know, arguably the original college hockey upset in the prime era of the WCHA, unfortunately, on the losing end for the Gophers.
Yeah, I'll go back even further. I think it was really good for college hockey. It wasn't good for us, but it was really good for college hockey that, and I knew Holy Cross was a good team. You look at, they had won 26 or 28 games. They had scoring. They had a really good goaltender. And so I knew that was going to be a difficult game. But you could even go back further, where University of Alaska Anchorage went to powerhouse Boston College and only beat them once. They swept them in their own rink, and that was with Craig Janney, a lot of guys that went on. I think Billy Guerin was on that team even when they swept them. It was year Northern Michigan won it, and I believe 91, I think the year Northern Michigan won it. So that was a year. So that was kind of the original upset, but I think it did a couple things. It showed that the Atlantic League was for real, and whether it was before or soon thereafter, you see how often the Atlantic League knocked off, whether it was Michigan, Cornell, Minnesota, UNH. I mean, you can go right on down the line, Notre Dame. A lot of teams came from that league, or the CHA back in the day, and in a one game, anything can happen. That's the beauty of NCAA basketball, right? Everybody loves the upset in the NCAA basketball. So it was difficult. I think that team had some distractions. And I always said that a lot of guys were going to be signing pro contracts. And, so did some guys have, were they a little bit mentally distracted knowing that, geez, okay, well, if we beat Holy Cross, we're going to be able to beat North Dakota in the championship game that year in Grand Forks, and if not, I'm going to sign my NHL contract and move on. So I think we had a little of those distractions, but I don't want to take anything away from Holy Cross. They played well, and it just, you get to overtime, it's a bounce of a puck. They shoot a puck, goes off, actually I think it was a centering pass, went off our defenseman's skate right back to the same guy. Our goaltender moved, and they scored. So as disappointed as I was almost happy for the other side that, you know, the euphoria that they feel, because I've been on the other side when I was at Fairbanks, you know, going into Michigan State and winning a game back when they were a powerhouse. And so you understand what they're going through and what their kids are going through. And actually they played, I think they ended up losing by a goal or two to North Dakota the next night. So they were a good team, disappointing, but without question, that was a real kick in the gut because that was a good team. You know, we had some deficiencies that they always say that your deficiencies show up at the end. But that was as disappointing as it was for us. It was actually, I think, a good day for college hockey.
If you ever get a chance, Gophers fan or not, go try to find the Holy Cross radio guys broadcast. They yell for about 5 minutes after they score. Talk about that emotion. It's pretty cool. The next couple I have, it's a pair of them from 2007. First one, January 29th, Robbie Bina, Jeff Frazee, the 200-foot goal. And I think really the iconic moment of that is, of course, after the first period, you're walking across the ice and you give the triple stare as you're walking across the blue line to Jeff Frazee. Obviously, you're emotionally fired up. You're in the moment. Have you ever talked with Frazee with that? Do you look back on that and kind of think like, oh, geez, I wish I would have done that? Or it just is what it is?
Well, it was at the Robbie. I remember the death stare at St. Cloud when one went in, and it was an offside thereafter, and I think he got the hook after that one. But, you know, it's one of those things, and it happens in NHL. You see those fluky goals, and it happens in college. It happens at high school. It happens at every level. So, you know, that's just one of those fluky deals. I remember, I think it was the same – no, it wasn't the same year, but I remember the first game at Ralph Engelstad Arena. We scored on a goal like that in 0-2. Actually, it had been fall of 0-1 in the first game at Ralph Engelstad Arena that October. I think, I don't know if it was Jordan Leopold or who launched one from about the top of our circles and scored in very similar fashion. So if you do this long enough, you're going to be on each side of those fluky goals.
Speaking of fluking goals, the other one happened in 07 as well, and arguably one of the best hockey games Nick and I have ever seen. WCHA Final Five, Blake Wheeler. Don't know why he was diving to prevent that icing, but I'm glad he scored against Lamoureux, because I felt like Lamoureux is a really dramatic goaltender to begin with. But when you saw that goal go in, just the flukiest of plays, you know, was there just kind of like, I can't believe that just happened. I still can't believe it happened, even to this day myself.
Yes, but you know what? Great athletes create great moments, too. I always believe that, and certainly Blake Wheeler was a great athlete, and that was a heck of a game. It was interesting. I think it was this spring that game was rebroadcast, and when everything was dead, and I watched it from start to finish, and it's like, oh, my gosh, the pace, the quality of the players, the packed atmosphere. I mean, that was as good as it gets, and that was a heck of a game. I mean, I don't care if it was 13 years ago. You put all those guys on the ice now, and some of them are still playing the NHL. It was just a really, really good college hockey game and two really good teams. And, you know, we got the better of it that game. Unfortunately, the next weekend, they beat us in overtime in the regional final to go to St. Louis. But, you know, Blake Wheeler was a great athlete, tremendous skater, and just one of those kind of like in the 80 Olympics when, you know, they didn't give up on that play at the end of the second period and scored that goal with 1 second to go to turn that game against Russia around. Same, very similar, that Blake never gave up on that play. And with his 6'5" height and reach, that he was able to chip that puck over the goaltender. Now, if the goaltender would have stood up, he probably wouldn't have been able to do it. But, you know, he kind of went down to try to poke check at the exact same time. So I always say it was a little bit of a fluky play, but at the same time, you know, a great athlete can come through and make a play like that.
And the last one I have for you, 2014, a bit of good and bad. Justin Hall, of course, his goal in a game with half a second left, in a game that arguably I thought North Dakota was the better team by a mile. And then unfortunately, Shane Gostisbehere goes +7 two nights later for Union to win the national championship. Can you kind of talk about those two games? And then, you know, going into that national championship as well, knowing that you won it in 02 and 03, did you kind of just know like how tough that uphill battle was going to be to win a national championship?
Yeah, I you know, if you go back the previous year, that's I believe when we lost that game to Yale, and Yale went on to win the national title that year. And after that, I believe it was, you know, Bukestad, Howla, Olt, Nate Schmidt, and I think Budish could have come back one more year. So all five guys left our team that year. And we looked at that year, it was going to be a rebuilding year. We had six freshman forwards on that team. And so, you know, I never dreamed we'd have that type of year, but everything kind of came into play for us. We had a good defensive core. Adam Wilcox had a terrific year in goal for us. And we were able to get to back to the Frozen Four. North Dakota might have had a little bit of the better play in that game, but Adam was really good. And certainly we took that penalty at the end, towards the end of the game, and you're just get us to overtime. And I mean, it is one of the most amazing plays that you got to face off in your own zone. You're shorthanded. There's probably, 10 seconds left to go in the game, in the regulation. And then we end up scoring in such dramatic fashion. I've never been a part of a game like that to end it like that. And it was thrilling. It was euphoria. I think the hardest part for us, I don't think we got to sleep that Thursday night until 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning, because it was a late game. I don't even think we got out of the facility till after midnight. You're eating your post-game meal at 1 o'clock in the morning. And then as an athlete, even as a coach, it's really hard to gear down. But I knew Union was really good. They had won, I think, their league 3 years in a row. They hadn't lost since mid-June. And quite frankly, they were a little deeper than we were, especially up front. They had a good veteran team. Obviously, Gosta Spear, and I think they had 3 or 4 other guys playing the NHL off that group. They had beat Boston College in the semifinals. And that team, over not only that year, over the course of a number of years, won a lot of games, because they were in the Frozen Four in 12 as well, as we were. And so they had those veterans that had been through it. And you know what? I truly believe they were the best team that year. They were a little bit deeper. You know, in hindsight, I would have liked to have used a timeout in that first period, but we couldn't get to another whistle when they scored that barrage of goals, because all we needed was a whistle stop and it was going to be a TV timeout. But we pulled back. You know, it was a one goal game at the end, but we just couldn't get the equalizer, and then they scored that empty netter at the end. So it was a thrill to get there. It wasn't necessarily expected that year. And, you know, even though difficult things for our fans, that when you get there, they want you to win it, which is the great thing and about coaching at the University of Minnesota. So I feel fortunate in my coaching career. I always say I experienced it all. I mean, been to Frozen Fours, won a national title in overtime, lost a national title in overtime, won one, you know, in regulation, lost one in regulation. Same thing, even Final Fives, won them in overtime, lost them in overtime in coaching career. So, you know, when you do it as long as I did, you get to experience it all. And that's one of the things I'm grateful for, is that I was able to experience so many different things over the course of my career in coaching. And I enjoyed it. There was days that there were some difficult days, like when you get beat by Holy Cross, but then there's some fabulous days when you win a national title, or just, you know, have some big wins along the way that are really gratifying that, you know, maybe general public doesn't even remember.
Don, certainly over the course of a long coaching career, you've had the opportunity to coach some really good athletes that you mentioned. We talked about Blake Wheeler. You coached a Hobie Baker winner and Jordan Leopold back in 2002. But do any couple of players stick out to you as being some of the most talented that you've had over the coaching career, or maybe a couple that came through that, you know, maybe surprised you the most improved? Like, can you name a couple of players that to you, or maybe just the most talented that you've coached in your coaching career?
Yeah, I mean, it's funny because now I'm going to give you a name that you'll never even probably heard of, and his name is Steve Moria. And I had him when I was up in Alaska Fairbanks, and he actually, when we were a Division I independent, set the record for most points in a year at 109. He ended up being signed by the New York Rangers. Unfortunately, the new regime came in that spring, and they went from, you know, wanting skill to more brawn at that time. He ended up playing into his 50s in Europe. Just a phenomenal athlete. And I think in his 3-year career, there's only one game he didn't score a point. And he went in, he was trying to break the, and I think he did at the time, the consecutive point streak at Michigan State. We were, one of their former teammates, our players had the record, and we were going in to play Michigan State, and that was a big thing. You wanted to make sure he kept stayed off the board. I think he scored the first shift of the game to keep the point streak intact. And unfortunately, I think the next night we played Ferris, and we ended up getting shut out, the only time in his career. He was a great athlete, and that's one that really, really stands out for me. Obviously, Blake Wheeler was a really great athlete, and so there's two things: are you a really great athlete or a really great hockey player? And not necessarily one the same. I mean, Thomas Vanek's offensive skill level, his release, probably was the best I've been around. But I had a lot of really, really good players. You know, obviously Jordan went in, Hobie Baker was a really talented player. But you don't win, it's like anything, without really good players. And I was fortunate to be a part of a lot of great teams and be on the ice with a lot of great players.
2018 comes around, and your time in Minnesota kind of is coming to an end. You've actually had one losing season at the U. You missed four games that year in 2009 with sarcoidosis, and actually went 17-18. So as far as losing records go, not too bad. But there's always kind of been talk. I'm sure you've heard that some people say that the Don Lucia era went too long. I don't believe that, but like, how do you respond to that? And kind of when 2018 rolled around, how did you know that it was finally time for you to move on from the U?
Well, a couple things. One, I never wanted to coach beyond 60. That was kind of my own, you know, it's somebody else's turn. I never felt like I wanted to coach till I was 70 or keep going. You get to the point where you want to turn it over to somebody else. So I think there was a lot of it's a combination. Obviously, they want us to win every year, and I understand that. We had won the league 6 years in a row. It had never been done in college hockey. Unfortunately, there was a couple of difficult losses when you're in the one game shot in the NCAA tournament. You know, had we won a couple of games there, you know, things might have been viewed a little bit differently. But I still think a lot of it came down to the breakup of the WCHA. And for our fans, and you still see it, the disappointment of not being a part of the league. And quite frankly, Minnesota fought it. Joel Moturi didn't want to be a part of the Big Ten league at the time. Don Lucia didn't want to be a part of the league. Minnesota Gopher fans didn't want to be a part of the league. So that was a very difficult breakup. And I think our fans we're disappointed. I think it two things. I think the cost of the ticket at Gopher games became very, very high. I think they've started to look at that a little bit the last few years. I think that was an impact, and also losing our rivals. I think those are the two things that had the most impact. Then you start to think as attendance fell off. I mean, we still had at home, I think we had the best home record over the previous like 4 or 5 years, so we were still winning at home, but the fans weren't coming. Then you start to think, well, geez, is it me, is it time, you know? It goes through your mind because you want what's best for the program. So I knew I had one more year beyond 18-19 on my contract, and I went into Mark before the year even began, and I sat down, I said, it doesn't matter to me if I coach at the Minnesota 19 or 20 years. I've been doing it 30 plus years as a head coach. I just feel that I'd rather make the decision before the year even begins. You know, I felt that team was good enough to get in the NCAA tournament. And unfortunately, that was a year where all seven games in the final day went against us. And, we didn't get in the NCAA tournament. But my decision had been made the previous fall. And we had it all worked out. I would stick around that last year and help out. I just felt that it was better for the program to move on with a new person in charge. I felt that it didn't make a lot. There's going to be a big turnover, so it was going to be a big recruiting year that following year. I just felt it was the next coach should decide on who's coming in at that time. And I was fine with it. I missed the players that first year. I missed some of the elation of walking in the locker room after a big win. But it was just time. It was time for me. It was time for the program to have some fresh blood. And I think I been around long enough to know that you're better off leaving a year too soon than a year too late. And I think it was just better for everybody at that point in time. They hired a really good person in Bob. Bob and I had worked together. We have a tremendous relationship now. We talk every week. I stop by every so often. He always made me feel very welcome over the last couple of years. And I know what he's going through and when he's there at times. So I think I'm a good sounding board for him, but it's nice to see such a good friend take over that program. And I know he'll do wonderful things, and hopefully during his tenure, he can win a national title there.
Don, no question, you know, when you take the year off, as you mentioned, with Mark, you end up kind of being a sort of an executive assistant, if I remember correctly. And now all of a sudden you get approached with an opportunity to become a conference commissioner. A couple of things on that. Did you ever think that you'd be approached with a position to be a commissioner of a league? And number two, how's it feel like preparing? And now that you have the position, what's it been like trying to get this thing rolling?
Well, I can go back to, Bruce McLeod reached out to me back, about taking over the WCHA when he was leaving. And I had some of the coaches call me to see if I had interest at that time. It was just too soon. I wasn't ready to give up the coaching at that point in time. So it didn't work out. And so when I got approached in March, I was actually up at our place in Alaska, and I got a phone call from Morris Kurtz. And I, to be honest, I didn't even know the position was open at the time. And whether I would apply. And so I had to quickly, because I think the position closed on a Monday, and this was like Thursday or Friday. So I had to get a resume together and cover letter and do all that and send in my information. I was able to do that. And then I just went through the process, and I think I was the right place at the right time. I think they wanted somebody with a great hockey background to help put this together, because I told them, I said, if you're looking for a marketing guru, I'm not your guy, but if you want somebody that understands the NCAA, understands college hockey, knows the commissioners, can lead the conference in that way, and surround myself with some, certainly more qualified people in the business end, then I think it can be a good thing. So right from the get-go, I didn't need a job. I thought it would be a challenging but enjoyable job. That's the beauty of my whole career. I kind of look at it as, I never felt like I went to work. I enjoyed going to work every day, and I think this can be the same thing. So my goal is to help college hockey, and that's why I'm doing it. Not only help the CCHA, but certainly college hockey in the West, because we've had our challenges and trials, and hopefully I can help this new group. They're very committed in what they're doing. I think that's one of the things that impressed me. We're very excited to have St. Thomas be part of this league. I think they have a chance to be an outstanding college hockey program. So we have a nice 18 league moving forward. We want to try to get the refereeing situation worked out and maybe try to get a consortium in the West. It just seems to me then when you have three different conferences intermingled between Minnesota and Michigan and in the West like we do, it makes a whole lot more sense for a referee to be able to referee Minnesota one night, Mankato one night, and St. Cloud one night, and not have to get in a plane and go anywhere. So we'll see where that leads us, but I'm looking forward to being part of the solution to some of the issues that college hockey faces in the future.
Can't imagine what your cover letter and resume looks like, to be totally honest. It's got to be interesting. Only a couple more questions here for you, Don. And once again, thank you for joining us. You're part of now the CCHA 2.0, if you will. The original disbanded in 2013, and that kind of prompts a listener question that we had from our listener, Derek Felksa. And he asks, as you're a person who once coached in Alaska, are those programs, the Alaska programs along with Alabama Huntsville, are they viable as independents if they can't find a conference to be in, especially as the new CCHA gets rolling?
Well, it's not going to be easy. When I go back, I was coaching as an independent in the late 80s, early 90s. Actually, my last year, we were a Division I an affiliate member of the CCHA. Anchorage was an affiliate member of the WCHA at that time. We were each going to get in the conference the following year. Back then, you had, the Alaska schools could play each other. You had Air Force, you had Huntsville, you had Michigan Dearborn. You had some other Division I independents. It's a little more problematic now because there's fewer independents. More teams you could probably play. And I think there was a few more teams back in the day more interested in going to Alaska because they hadn't been there, the novelty. So the critical thing, I think, for them is going to be, can they get a schedule? Can they get some home games? But they also have, all three of those programs have some severe budget issues. Obviously, we see Huntsville raise the money to get their funding for one more year. Alaska's got some real budget issues right now with the price of oil. The universities have had some severe cuts. How is that going to translate into what they do in their athletic department in the future is a real question mark. And I think that's one of the reasons why the seven teams broke away and wanted to be affiliated with like-minded institutions that have a real commitment to try to win at the highest level. And ultimately, that's what happened. And I think the final straw might have been when Anchorage moved from their games at Sullivan Arena back on campus in a 900,000 facility, and just not enough. And so the commitment level is what happened. You never say never that they can't do it. How long is a question mark. Can they get back in the league down the line with a renewed commitment and renewed funding level? Again, that's all to be determined.
Coach, certainly, you know, trying to start any league per se, you know, in any time is obviously a big challenge, as you mentioned, but certainly with today's environment with the coronavirus pandemic, I imagine is making this even more of a challenge. Has there been sort of a thought on, you know, because we certainly just don't know what this future is going to look like? You know, obviously there's a hope with a vaccine the next couple of months, but nothing's guaranteed. Is there sort of a kind of contingency plans and whether this thing sticks around for another year or so? You know, is that part of the process, or, you know, how is, you know, all this pandemic news shaping how you're trying to get the league going for next year?
Well, it really hasn't had an impact on us yet. I mean, there's so many other things that we have to deal with, whether it's schedule or what we're going to do about referees, putting a staff together within the office. So there's a lot more on the plate that's ahead of that right now. I think college hockey is trying to deal with it. What's college hockey going to look like this year? I think we're all hopeful that this won't impact us into next season. I'm just grateful that the CCHA begins in the fall of 21 and not the fall of 20, so it does give us a year. I think as we move forward and see how college campuses handle this in the fall into next spring, I think it'll be more of an issue when you get into January, February. We'll start to look at where things are at, what's happening with college hockey, and the impact that'll have possibly in 21-22.
Last question here for you, Don. Just kind of a personal one, of course. Mario Lucia, draft pick of the Minnesota Wild, you know, still playing hockey, I believe, in the AHL. When you're not, you know, working as a commissioner, what is, you know, especially with this time with COVID, you know, what do you do kind of to relax, catch up with family, that sort of thing? You know, what has been kind of your lifestyle, especially in this altered lifestyle that we have now?
Well, it's interesting because we have spent a lot, my wife and I have spent a lot of time up in Alaska at our home on the Kenai River. So we were there in actually the month of February and March. We originally were supposed to fly back in mid-March, and my daughter was in transition and selling their house, and they were at our home and just had a baby. So we elected to wait a couple more. So we flew back the end of March. But it really hasn't disrupted us that much. I mean, we flew to Arizona, picked up my mom, brought her back, flew back to Alaska in May, came back, flew back. I flew back in June, came back, flew back the end of June, and I just flew back again. And there's not a lot of COVID up in Alaska, especially where we're at, Soldotna. So it really, really hasn't altered what we've done, especially this summer. We can do a lot of fishing right off our property, a lot of salmon fishing and some sightseeing. And I'm either, I get out and walk or run pretty much every day. So I got to get my exercise. So that's still, I've been able to do that. So we just came back last week because a lot of grandchildren's birthdays, and we'll probably spend most of September into early October back in Alaska, and then we'll be here for the winter. And the only place I've really seen the change is, you know, we couldn't go to mass for a few months, and now you go and it's every other aisle, and communion is a little bit different. So that's probably where I've seen that change most of all. And then not having any sports on TV or watching hockey playoffs in August seems a little bit odd. But hopefully we can get all this behind us, and it's crazy times, and who knows? COVID might change a lot after the election too, because unfortunately it's become really political.
Former Golden Gopher head coach and current CCHA Commissioner Don Lucia, thank you again for joining us this afternoon and look forward to speaking to you again in the future.
All right. Thanks, guys. Have a great day.
You too. Thanks, Don.
Take the Huskies Warming House podcast wherever you go. Find the newest episodes or listen to your favorite on iTunes and Podbean. Get all the latest news and updates at huskieswarminghousepodcast.com and look for our Facebook page, the Huskies Warming House Podcast, as well as our Twitter feed, at Warming House Den. Our Twitter feed will host trivia updates and questions for fans, as well as a mailbag where you can tweet us anytime with your questions, concerns, or listener suggestion. And for business inquiries, email us at huskieswarminghousepodcast@outlook.com.
And what a wonderful time here again. Thank you to Don Lucia, now current CCHA commissioner, college hockey champion, two times at the national level. No, I know this has been an interview we've been looking forward to for quite some time. I know that for Don, I got to interview him a couple different times back in 2013, the last WCHA Frozen Five at the Xcel Energy Center. That was when his team lost to Colorado College in the semifinal round. So a little bit of different conversation there, but certainly kind of cool to get to meet one of your, I suppose, idols in terms of college hockey coaching here on the podcast.
Yeah, for me, it's a really special moment, particularly because obviously we had Bob Motzko on, who was an assistant, you know, during that time. And then that was the first college hockey game in 2002 when Grant Bertolini scored the game winner in overtime. You know, that was the first game I ever watched on TV. My dad went to the University of Minnesota in 81, so that's why I am a Gophers fan. So I actually got to meet Grant Bertolini at the CCM National Invitational Tournament in Plymouth in 2015. So that was cool. So to kind of cap it off with the trifecta of people that were really integral to that, and Don Lucia, and a guy that, you know, I just grew up watching Gophers hockey. You know, that was my Friday night, as if we weren't playing somewhere or that sort of thing. That was, you know, we came home from practice and that was what we did. So for me, it was, I know that, you know, I don't know if I fanboyed it up a little bit, but I know I when we mentioned to him at the end, of course, you know, for him, he's like, oh yeah, you know, it's cool. I'm glad that, you know, it means a lot to you. But you know, that's how it is, right? You know, with this podcast, you know, we might just think that we're talking hockey every week, but for someone, it might be what gets them through their Monday. So, you know, it's just, it's awesome to see the hockey world be such a tight knit community, and to be able to talk to someone that you really looked up to for so long, for me was really cool. And it's interesting that you mentioned the old WCHA as well. As we move into our next topic, Nick, is I was actually there in March of 2012. I believe it might have been the last playoff series for the old WCHA, if not one of the last. And they actually played the University of Alaska Anchorage Seawolves and won that series. The Golden Gophers did. I have pictures of it. They're up on Twitter, actually, on our Twitter page for at Warming House Den. But that building was 7/8 full, and that was considered a poor attendance, you know, back then. So kind of interesting to see how the college hockey landscape has changed. And Nick, as we just got some news earlier this week, the University of Alaska Anchorage, the college landscape is changing for the worse for them.
It is, you know, kind of interesting timing too, as we asked Don Lucia about the sustainability of the Alaska schools with the creation of the CCHA. And literally within the 24 hours of our interview that we recorded on Tuesday and Wednesday, was when the announcement came in. So kind of weird how it just the timing and everything kind of fell into place for us. But Alaska Anchorage announcing that they will disband its hockey program after the season, again, assuming we have a season. No, I want you to tell the listeners and the viewers watching this, there's some startling numbers that are forcing this to happen. And I think it's important for our listeners to hear this and to, yes, these numbers are startling for Alaska Anchorage, but reality is they're not the only ones in this boat. A lot of colleges are in this sort of boat that Alaska Anchorage is seeing right now.
Yeah, it definitely is. I just went and picked up a UAA jersey, by the way, too. The Seawolf, the legend of the Seawolf is actually, it's a legendary mythical creature that is supposed to bring good luck on whoever, you know, looks upon it. Unfortunately, UAA's luck has officially run out, cutting their men's hockey programs, women's gymnastic, and both men's and women's skiing. The changes go into effect for the 2021-22 season. So UAA has one more year left at the Division I level for hockey. They are expected to save approximately $2.5 million per year. And the decision for them, since the fiscal year of 2014, the state funding for just the University of Alaska Anchorage has declined by $34 million. And in August 2019, the University of Alaska leadership came to an agreement with the governor on a $70 million reduction in state funds to the university system in Alaska that's going to take place this year in 2021 and in 2022. So Nick, not only is it devastating to see kind of what transpired to lead up to UAA's disbanding their hockey program at the Division I level, but you know, with these Alaska schools that are looking for a league and are potentially going to be independents and struggle enough with budgets and with travel, $70 million reduction for the university system in Alaska just does not bode well for a team like Alaska Fairbanks, who's trying to make sure they have a home after next season with the WCHA kind of disappearing and the CCHA taking its place.
I think at this point, I think it's appropriate to say no, and I use that word, you know, purposefully, is that, you know, you start to worry for Alaska Fairbanks at this point as well, being that, you know, you talk about the Alaska college system and the reduced funding. When we had Heather Weems on a few weeks back, she talked about the revenue streams and how you can't rely on state and federal funding. A lot of it's coming from donors and from, you know, alumni, and how really for sports to, you know, continue on, a lot of it has to be generated by those sources. And this proves it right here, that, you know, the funding that they were getting, it's being cut. And as we know, that as time goes on, inflation goes up, so things are costing more. You're not getting as much money from the state and federal levels. So it's kind of a two-handed sword, really, if you look at it, that's at the helm of these Alaska schools. Again, Anchorage, the one that's announcing the cut of the program. It really is sad because, you know, we welcomed Long Island University, the Sharks, and we were excited, right? Because we said, hey, 61 teams now in college hockey, the sport's growing. And now we're seeing with the budgetary cuts that now we can bring it back down to 60. And it certainly looks like could be down to at least 59, if not 58. Again, we talk about Alabama Huntsville and how, yes, they will survive this year, but again, the long-term viability of the program is still up in the air. Alaska Fairbanks, with, I would assume, a pretty similar situation in terms of budget, will be facing them. You talk about being an independent conference, and who are they going to play? They got to fly no less than 5-6 hours to play somebody here in the Midwest, on the East Coast. I mean, really, what's the closest school to them? It's not Arizona State, is it? That's a lot of money for travel. It's just not something that seems sustainable for them when you have funding cuts. So it's sad, but we might, in the next couple of years, Noah, won't have a single college hockey program coming from the state of Alaska. And that, to me, that's a sad day for college hockey, honestly.
Yeah, absolutely. Especially talking with Don Lucia, his wife's from Fairbanks. And, you know, obviously, you know, you have the Kenai River Brown Bears up there too, in terms of junior hockey as well. So, I mean, it's a potential to have hockey up there. You know, there's no doubt that it can be done. Of course, we did talk with Nolan Walker, who is an Anchorage native, a couple episodes ago, and he talked about how he did have to leave the state, you know, to find some higher end hockey. So I think that, you know, 50 states, whether you're in the continuous 40 states or, you know, Alaska or Hawaii, finding a way to grow this great game is so important. I think their closest opponent might be one of the Colorado schools, maybe Air Force, something like that. You know, but I'm glad you mentioned Arizona State and Alabama Huntsville, because, you know, where college hockey is in jeopardy is if you hear schools like Minnesota or Ohio State, especially with this COVID situation, say that they don't have the funding for their schools. And the reason I mention that is because you look at Alaska Fairbanks, you look at Alabama Huntsville, you know, they're not even in the same position as ASU is, because ASU kind of has that namesake reputation, you know, and the vastness of their school. But then you look at the big schools like Ohio State and Minnesota, you know, part of their revenue, if they have a down year or they don't have a hockey season or they don't make a tournament or that sort of thing, you know, it's the Ohio State University, right? You've got a ginormous football program and a stadium that holds over 100,000 people, you know, that's going to generate revenue for you. Unfortunately, hopefully we're having a season for football this year as well. But, you know, it's just that discussion of how do you, especially during COVID, how do you support schools like Alabama Huntsville, you know, when the worry is that you're not even going to have those, you know, the big football seasons, the big basketball seasons, you know, March Madness, that sort of thing. It's just, you know, especially because I think the Seawolves logo is so cool. I mean, I think it's arguably the best logo in college hockey, but it's like, you know,
besides the one that's hanging over your right shoulder, right?
Well, of course. Sorry. it's just super sad because of the fact that obviously you're a little bit older than I am, but you and I have both grown up watching, you know, the Seawolves come to town. There was, Don Lucia mentioned himself, the kind of the aura of going to see them, seeing a televised game if the Gophers go up to Alaska or that sort of thing, or having them come down, you know, and seeing, you know, our brothers from Alaska come down and, you know, hang out and play hockey. It's just really depressing to me, because I think there's such an allure of having the uniqueness of those two schools, and some good hockey players that come in there. I believe Colton Parenko is a Alaska Fritz player, very good hockey player. So, you know, it's not like talent can't go up there and learn. Is Brooks Like another one in that group? I'm not sure if
I think he might be.
Jay Beagles and Alaska Anchorage Seawolf, if I'm not mistaken. We'll definitely have to fact check those. But I mean, there's current NHL players that have played there. It's not like there was ever bad hockey up there. So I don't know. I keep just kind of talking roundabout about how depressed I am about it, but it's almost not real to me to know that, you know, just this weird fluctuation in college hockey has really brought these ebbs and flows, these highs and lows for us, just to see that college hockey is never going to look the same. But it's not like we're disbanding the WCHA. It's not one big explosion. It's these little minefields that we keep stepping on and slowly discovering. And it's a really painful way to learn that lesson.
And I want to point to what Don Lucia answered about that too. When we asked the fan question, you know, obviously reading between the lines of his answer, you got the sense that there was a known issue of funding with the Alaska schools. And it seemed like, again, in a conference, it's a collaborative thing, right? So if some schools are struggling, that's inherently going to affect the conference as a whole. So there was, for at least from what I get, if people are asking, was this purposeful to leave out the two Alaska schools? I think the answer we can say is yes, it was. And it just now, with the confirmation of Alaska Anchorage, looking at the financial situation, and then obviously now being an independent school as of next year, they realize that this is unsustainable. And it is sad, because it shows you just how much money is not being directed toward, you know, in a larger conversation, the education system, how much it's struggling in terms of funding. We can go down a very deep rabbit hole about that conversation. I will digress from that. But at the end of the day, yes, this was a formidable strategic move by the seven schools to reestablish themselves, to make sure that financially it's sustainable, because, you know, we were sad that one, if not now two, maybe three schools in the next couple of years may no longer be with us as programs. But if you're going to take, you know, the worst for word, I'd rather see only three schools go down versus more schools go down, if that's what it takes. Obviously, we would love to see zero. We'd love to see added more. But if that's where we're at, and no question the pandemic has certainly, you know, made this a much worse situation. There's no question about it. And I still think that there still will be impacts felt from this for many years after this. But I think, yes, I mean, we can now answer the question. This was a purposeful move, and that it really was to secure the future of college hockey here in the Midwest. And it's sad that this is going to be the effect of that, but you know, how quickly this kind of came about, this is, you know, again, a tough day for college hockey all around.
You know, it's interesting too, as we kind of wrap up our show here, the one more thing I want to posit to you, and obviously, you know, the state's not looking to divert funding from just hockey, right? It affects more than that. It affects their basketball programs. It affects, you know, even academics potentially to some degree. You know, it's
yes,
systemic issue that is just more than just Division I hockey. Granted, that's probably one of their bigger sports or programs on that campus. But it affects everybody in that community. But the one thing I kind of wanted to ask, and it's very interesting, you know, as Don Lucia has ties to Alaska and that area, having coached there and having family there and having a place there up at the Kenai River, does the CCHA in some respects, and I know you touched on a little bit, especially unfortunately with him as commissioner, have a little bit of blood on their hands in some respects? Or is the CCHA understanding that the blood on their hands is them having to essentially kind of cut off their own arm to survive the rest of the body, if that makes any sort of sense?
It's a both, honestly. I think both can be true. I think, again, you don't form a league like this out of random. I mean, there's a reason why the Big Ten was formed, not because just a bylaw. And again, we saw Don address that too. They fought it. They understood what college hockey is, especially in this market. And really across the nation, right, is that there's a dependency, and it was so successful when you had these rivalries, when you had, you know, these marquee games every single weekend. One thing the old WCHA prior to 2013 was known for was every weekend was a rivalry weekend. It was like an entire regular season of playoff hockey. It really was. That's what drew people to it. Now, again, when money talks, and now when you have that conversation about lack of funding, we get why the Big Ten maybe is partly a big reason why these schools went that way. There's a TV contract, there's guaranteed money there. And especially in a pandemic, is that possibly a safety net? Absolutely it is. I'm, as much as I hate the Big Ten for disbanding the great rivalries of the WCHA, let's talk about the antithesis argument to that. Where would college hockey be right now if maybe this Big Ten wasn't there and the financial backing that it provides? You know, these are questions that we may never know the answer to, but it's an interesting thought. It really is. But yes, I do think that they're looking at long-term sustainability. We've talked now with Craig Dahl. We've talked with Bob Motzko. We talked with Don Lucia. And we keep hearing the same thing, Noah. They want to reinvigorate those old rivalries. We want to get back to more regionality play. Everybody who's around college hockey understands that that's where they need to revamp it. That's where fan interactions will go up, where, again, tickets can be sold more. There's more interest in the sport. And then maybe those revenues can be self-generating. And maybe we can add more college hockey programs. Again, St. Thomas going to Division I, that's going to help. So is there a silver lining here? Sure. That doesn't mean that there's going to be some hard transition times. And as you mentioned, yes, I do think this is college hockey. Understand there is a necessary loss that is going to be for the betterment of the whole. It's a tough way to go. But again, I think in their minds, that's exactly where they think they have to be at this current state.
Yeah, last quick question. I know I just said that, but so let's say there's not a season this year. Alaska Anchorage never plays another hockey game at the Division I level. What do you do to honor that program in that scenario? Not only in general, if there is a season, but for you, what's something that maybe should be done for a program that was around for a fairly long time?
I'm not sure there's a really good answer to that. Because, you know, you talk about leaving a legacy, leaving memories, and those fade over time. But what you can do is not let something die in vain, right? You understand that if we're going to have this argument that this was a necessary evil, right? And if we're going to have that, then we have to make sure that we take steps as college hockey, NCAA Division I, I would even argue all the way down to Division III, that we relook at how we're doing things. That means if we need to, again, have that exhibition schedule where Minnesota and St. Cloud are playing, the Gophers as well as the Bulldogs, really reinvigorate the rivals, get the fans more entertained and looking forward to the weekend games. And that to me is where it has to be. If we let this school die off, and if more are going to follow, such as Fairbanks and maybe Alabama Huntsville, again, we're speculating. You know, obviously, we don't know what is going to happen in the future. I would love to have a crystal ball that told me what's going to happen in the future. That would make life so much easier, Noah. But, you know, we'll step away from that. But we have to better concrete establish college hockey in its finances and the fan interaction with the sport. We just have to get it better. If we don't, then we're not doing the right thing. Then that chop off the arm was just more... just a mirage. There was no meaning to it. So we have to get college hockey better. We have to get the fans more invested in the sport. And we have to make sure that there's, you know, finances there to support it long term. So to me, that's how you honor this tough loss to the college hockey community, is you try to put into place some systematic stuff, whether it's finances or, you know, just again, getting everybody almost more excited about the sport. So that way we can try to prevent more schools dropping off in the future.
Certainly looking to grow that sort of excitement and hoping that there's a season this year. One thing you can look forward to us from us, I should say, as we wrap up our show, is we have three very special guests that are going to be joining us next week. It's Jackson Caster, Joey Lamoureux, and LA Kings fifth round draft pick David Rennick, the three goaltenders from the St. Cloud State Huskies team, are going to be joining us in episode 26. But for Nick Maxson and myself, Noah Grant, this has been episode 25, our Back to School special. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter, subscribe to us on Facebook, and above all, have a wonderful week and a wonderful Saturday night.